You're listening to Faith and Reason 360. I'm Debo Dykes.
And I'm David Dykes.
And as I mentioned in my introduction of episode one, we're in the season of Advent, which is the period of four Sundays and weeks before Christmas, or the coming of Jesus into the world. And today, Faith and Reason is bringing you episode two of our four-part Advent podcast series. Episode 2 is titled The Infancy Story of Matthew as Parabolic Overture. And we are very excited again to welcome as our special guest, John Dominic Crossan. Hey, Dom.
Hello, Debo, and hello, David. Nice to be back again.
Yes, it is.
Thank you. As Dr. Crossan mentioned in episode 1, Matthew's account of the birth of Jesus is contained in chapters 1 and 2 of the Gospel of Matthew. So if you care to follow along, then you will find this material in the Bible in Matthew chapters 1 and 2.
Okay, so I'm going to start by asking you, Dom, what design does Matthew have? How does he organize his, may I say, what would we call it, parabolic
overture?
Overture, yes.
Overture. All right, let me do something rather impertinent, and I'll do it carefully. I'm going to imagine myself in Matthew's position, and I say it's a little bit impertinent, but I have spent over 60 years with the Gospels, word for word. So allow me that indulgence for a moment.
Of course.
Matthew is probably a Pharisaic Jew. I think he was a Pharisee, I suspect. And he is in debate with other Pharisaic Jews. He is a Messianic or Christic. I'm using the word Christic, not Christian, because that's a later term, but Christic, Messianic Jew. And let me imagine that he's just written his gospel, and now he's got to the point where he knows he has to put in, or he wants to put in at least, an overture. Remember that I said in the first one that he's going to be writing, or his scribe is going to be writing down this in Greek uncial, capital letters, wall to wall. You're not going to waste any manuscript with big margins, and it's going to be hard to read. It's going to be physically difficult to read, even to an audience. So the idea of giving a sort of an overture up front, a thematic summary, is like you and I might put in at the beginning or in the flaps of our book what the book is about, something to help the reader. Mm-hmm. So it's a reader-friendly gesture. Okay.
Yes.
So now imagine he's finished his gospel. So we have sitting in front of me, Matthew, a text which we later know as Matthew 3, to 28. We don't have 1 and 2 yet. All right, I'm thinking to myself, the big theme I want to make in this writing, I have made in this writing, is that Jesus is the new Moses. Not replacing Moses, that would be crude and vulgar, but bringing Moses to perfection. A sort of up-to-date Moses, a new, improved, up-to-dated Moses. So that's what I want to do. Now, okay, I've written my gospel, and everyone knows that Moses wrote the Pentateuch. At least in those days, that's what everyone took for granted. The Pentateuch are the first five books of the Bible, of course. So when I'm writing my gospel, thinks Matthew, I have written five great speeches of Jesus. Five, not six, not seven, not four, five. Of course there had to be five. And in case anyone doesn't get it from the five, the first one, the first great speech of Jesus, is what we are going to call, and Matthew wouldn't like it, by the way, the Sermon on the Mount. Mm. And Matthew would be screaming, Sermon Mount, you guys missed it. This is the new law from the new Moses on the new Mount Sinai.
Oh, wow.
It's not just a Sermon on the Mount. So the very first one is sort of a grand summary of what Jesus is about. And he's going to say things like, you have heard what was said to them of old, but I say to you, wow, mm-hmm. This is authoritative. Mm-hmm. So Matthew thinks to himself, now surely everyone's going to get it. five great sermons, the new, beginning with the new Mount Sinai. And in case they haven't got it, I'm going to set the very last scene in Galilee when Jesus is departing this earth and saying, going therefore, teach all nations. Where am I going to put it? On the lake? No way. On a mount. And he like screams at us, do you get it, people? And of course, nobody in the first century could not get it.
Oh,
they couldn't not get it.
Right.
And if we can't get it, it's our problem.
Mm-hmm.
It really is our problem. And the way we solve our problem is by reading carefully, contextually, in its own historical matrix, as I said before, paying great attention to authorial intention. Okay, now, I'm back to Matthew, and I'm ready to start my prologue. And of course, I know immediately that this prologue has to announce Jesus as the new Moses. That's the whole theme of my gospel, so he has to be the baby Moses. Let me put it that way. He has to come into this earth as the baby Moses. So, let me think. Now, what, Matthew thinks, do I know about Moses? And what do all my readers, my hearers, know about Moses? Well, they all know, of course, the story of Exodus, that when Moses was born, Pharaoh in Egypt was conducting a pogrom, an attempt to kill all the male children. And Moses is almost killed and barely escapes with his life. So I have to tell a story in which Jesus is almost killed as an infant, as a baby, and escapes with his life. Okay, now. But I don't have much in Exodus. It's awful bare. And I also have Moses, Matthew is thinking, the popular stories, because at the time of the first century, at the time of Jesus' birth, the Jews not only had the biblical traditions, of course, but they also had popular sermons. Let's call them sermons. Midrashim, we call them as a fancier word, but let's say popular sermons on those texts. And the popular sermons had to answer questions which inquiring minds wanted to know. For example, people would ask the person giving the sermon, excuse me, why did God set up such a, excuse me, kind of stupid idea as having Moses, born in the middle of a pogrom? Couldn't God have adjusted the timing a few years before, a few years after? That seems like divine malfeasance. And in those popular accounts, the answer was quite clear. We have them, by the way. We still have them. Some of them are in Josephus. The answer was quite clear. Well, Pharaoh had a dream. And in that dream, he saw that a child to be born to the Jews in Egypt would outweigh all of Egypt. He saw in his dream a balance, and the balance went down, and the Jewish part went way down, and Egypt went way up. So Pharaoh wakes up. He calls together. Now, I hope you're hearing the echoes. He calls together all his wise men and says, where's this child? Where's this Jewish child to be born? And nobody seems to know. So he institutes the pogrom. So the answer is, he wasn't just born in a pogrom. The pogrom was designed to get him. Matthew says, so that's it. So when I write my story, Herod won't just be conducting a casual pogrom. He will have one in order to get Jesus as the new Moses. Now, there's one other thing he knows from his popular stories, Matthew knows. Because again, those inquiring minds said, well, wouldn't the fathers and mothers in Exodus, when they're told their children or their sons are going to be killed, wouldn't they practice abstinence and not produce any children? Why would they produce children to be slaughtered? And again, the answer in those popular accounts was, as soon as they heard about it, Amram and Jochebed, the parents of Moses-to-be, decided to practice abstinence. No more sexual marital intercourse. We will not have children. We will not bear children to be slaughtered. And then an angel, an angel appears in a dream. You're going, okay, I'm getting it, Matthew. I'm starting to get it. An angel appears in a dream and says, fear not, Amram. Go ahead with marital intercourse because the child to be born to you will be the savior of his people, Israel. Okay, now I'm Matthew, and I've got here on my desk all the stuff I need to do this. So I'm going to tell a story in which Jesus is born. And now I have to find out some way that Herod, who is the new Pharaoh, clearly he'd work well as a Pharaoh because we all know what he's like. So he's the new Pharaoh, and he's going to want to kill Jesus. So how do I get the story so he knows about Jesus? Oh, I could bring in these magi. And here's where you notice one of the cracks in the story that give away authorial intention. The magi, you remember, come from Iran. Interesting, is it not, to have three Iranians in the crib? Three Iranian wise men. They're not kings, by the way. They're absolutely not kings. They're scholars. There are three scholars. I like the idea of having scholars at the crib, by the way.
I thought you would.
Three scholars. Yeah. The magi come from the east, and they're following a star. Now, that's almost a jibe because, of course, the foundation of Rome is when Aeneas leaves Troy in the east and follows Venus's westward star all the way from Troy to Rome. Mm-hmm. So now we have a new star coming from the east, heading westward, and guiding the magi towards Jesus. And now you see the crack.
Mm-hmm.
If they're following a star, how come they have to stop in Jerusalem and ask for directions? Because we know in any case that men never ask directions, so this makes it impossible. this is unbelievable. Three men stop and ask directions. No way. Anyway, so then you see, of course, Matthew has to make them stop in Jerusalem for directions, or we don't get Herod into the story. If the three wise men come by land, let's say, around the Fertile Crescent, down the Levantine coast, past Jerusalem, straight into Bethlehem, with the star guiding them all the way, we can't attune this story to Moses. We have no pogrom. We have no death of threatened death. So he has to stop them at Now, anyone who's reading carefully and thinking, and that's always the danger when you read the New Testament, you might think, you should ask yourself, how come the star stops? How come it doesn't guide them straight to Bethlehem and have to make them stop in Jerusalem for instructions?
I always wondered about that.
Well, it's the great giveaway. It's where the authorial intention breaks through, as if Matthew stopped for a moment and said, let the reader understand. That only happens. It happens in Mark's gospel. It happens in the book of Revelation, where the author suddenly says, well, in case my readers aren't smart enough to get it, maybe I should say, let the reader understand. But anyway, he doesn't. Matthew takes it for granted that his first audience will get it without the slightest trouble. So they stop at Jerusalem, and because they stop at Jerusalem, of course, as mentioned in the first example, they ask, where's the newborn king of the Jews? And of course, that is, as I said before, high treason, king of the Jews, for the Rome appointed, and Rome had appointed, way back in the 30s BCE, had appointed Herod as king of the Jews, getting rid of the ancient Hasmonean dynasty and putting in the Herodian dynasty. Antony, and he wasn't called Augustus, he was called Octavian. Antony and Octavian had taken Herod the Great, as he's later called. It almost seems, you know, you're great if you kill enough people. Doesn't that sound right? If you kill enough people, if you're responsible for enough deaths, you're going to be called great. Anyway, that's a footnote. They take Herod up to the Temple of Jupiter on the Capitoline Hill in Rome and appoint him solemnly king of the Jews. Mm-hmm. Couldn't be more solemn. And then these three scholars from the east come looking for a newborn king of the Jews. And of course, Herod is appalled. This king is not out of this, sorry, this newborn king is not from my dynasty. This must be opposition. This must be treason. Asks them where, and then again, they're told in a dream, don't go back to Herod. Notice all the dreams.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There are five dreams. Okay, we're getting it. There's going to be five of everything's in this. There's five dreams in this. And we get it because there's no dreams in Luke. Matthew has dreams because, of course, it's controlled by a dream in the Moses story.
Yes.
So in any case, Herod the Great then decides on the massacre of the infants. Jesus, Mary, and Joseph run as a refugees, political refugees, to Egypt. And I mentioned before, that is a terrible, ironic statement, that instead of fleeing from Egypt to Israel under Moses, they now flee from Israel to Egypt under Herod. So Herod is the new Pharaoh. I mean, that, by the way, is kind of treason, you know? The appointed king of the Jews is the new Pharaoh, the first major villain, I suppose, in the Bible. So I now have my story, Matthew says. But he has one more thing to do. I think you can see the story. As Moses was almost killed in his infancy by the evil Pharaoh, Jesus is almost killed in his infancy by the evil Herod, and they flee in opposite directions. So we got the general scenario. But there's one other fivesome, but there's two other fivesomes, and they have to be five, as I said, because we were playing with the Moses number. Five times in this story, Matthew says, and so was fulfilled the prophecy. And they really aren't very good prophecies. I mean, they really aren't. They don't fit. If you go back and read the text from the Old Testament, Matthew is looking around to find five prophecies. It's not like these are five prophecies that his people always knew about, and he just sees their fulfillment. He really goes kind of desperately looking for something he can make it, because Jesus, I said before, Jesus is the new confronting the old. Herod, remember I mentioned before, Herod is confronted by this king of the Jews who's the new confronting the old. But to be more accurate, Jesus is not the new. He's right, something like, what would I call, the older than old confronting the old.
Mm-hmm.
He's not really new.
Mm-hmm.
He's the one that was awaited. He's the Messiah. He's the fulfillment of the law and the prophets. So he doesn't really confront, from the Jewish point of view, Herod as something brand new. It's something that was there before Herod, should have been there under Herod, and will replace Herod. It's the vision that's in the prophets and in the Torah of a just earth, mm-hmm. of an earth where you beat your swords into plowshares, your spears into the pruning hook, where you live under your own fig tree and your own olive, not somebody else's stolen one, and where no one makes you afraid. So Jesus is confronting, in these prophecies, something far deeper. It's old Herod being confronted by the far, far, far older hope and expectation of the Messiah. It's Jesus as the Messiah. So the prophecies are important, not in the individual ones, they're kind of lame, but in the whole prophetic expectation. And then one final fivefold. Matthew opens the whole story with a genealogy. Luke has one too, but Matthew has a genealogy. And it's a weird genealogy, because men give birth to men, give birth to men, give birth to men. Almost, it seems, without the assistance of women.
Right.
I mean, it's like the supreme patriarchal delusion of who's important. And then in this list of men begetting men, four times, and then with Mary, five, again, we're back with five, women suddenly interrupt the story. They suddenly interrupt the story. There's Tamar, there's Rahab, there's Ruth, there's, her name isn't given, but the wife of Uriah the Hittite. Then there's Mary. All women about whose birth in the biblical tradition, there is, let me put it, some surprise, shall I say. It's sometimes more than surprise, but Matthew is a little defensive about Mary. He's a little defensive about Mary because he is arguing with his fellow scribal Jews. If he said, after all, Mary was Jesus was conceived virginally, you could imagine opponents saying, "Ha ha! So no father. We don't know who the father is. Is that right, Matthew? We don't know the father. So maybe we're dealing with illegitimacy or something like that." So very defensively, he mentions these other stories about women who are in the genealogy of the Messiah, but all somewhat surprisingly there. And finally, that explains one other thing. Why on earth does Matthew even raise this issue about the possible illegitimacy of Jesus? You're not going to get anything like that in Luke. Luke just has the announcement to Mary, and then presumably Mary tells Joseph when he comes home from work and says, "I've got good news and bad news. I have a child and you aren't the father." But, you know, that's all left in our imagination. Nothing is said about how does Mary tell Joseph about it. Here in Matthew's account, he raises the specter of illegitimacy. Again, because he has to get, like the question of the Magi, he has to get in that Amram and Jochebed had decided, remember I told you, that they're going to abstain from having a child, and then they have to be told in a dream, go ahead and have a child because he'll be the Savior. So in this case, he raises that issue of Joseph going to not marry Mary, and then he's told in a dream again that he must. So when I look at this whole thing, and I look at this genealogy, and it's a genealogy of Jesus, the son of David, the son of Abraham. But then, that's the way it opens, but Moses even isn't mentioned in the genealogy, but he takes over the rest of the infancy story, and he takes over the rest of the gospel. So what's the difference between David, Abraham, and Moses? Well, Moses is the lawgiver. Moses is the one who rules by law. David rules by military power. Now, granted, in the Bible, it's military power on the side on the side of Israel, and Abraham is a nomad chieftain who also uses military power. He's a nomad warrior chieftain, and David is a royal warrior chieftain, and both of them are absorbed into, a little bit negated by maybe, Moses, who is the lawgiver. It's law, not force, not even force on the side of the good, if you want to put it that way, that is to rule Matthew's gospel. And all of that is packed like an atom, packed. And when you explode it, it explodes into the whole gospel. And it's all there in Matthew 1 and 2. And none of that, which I've just mentioned, will appear, of course, in Luke 1 and 2.
So I can imagine the people who first heard or read Matthew's stories, there would be a great deal of excitement because from scene one, they would begin to recognize where we're headed, that this is about the one who comes to deliver Israel. Does that make sense?
Yes, it would. No, I don't honestly think they could miss it. It's not, I hope, that I'm reading scholarship back into it and ordinary people in the first century wouldn't. No, because these are the popular stories. If you're simply presuming they'd read Exodus 1-2, now nobody's reading Exodus 1-2, though they'd all know the story every Passover, of course. So the popular stories, the technical term is midrashim. These are like commentaries on it. So if a preacher was telling the story, now modern preachers don't do that. They kind of think they have to stick to the text, as it were. But any ancient preacher would have known that you have to jizz up this story. There's not enough stuff in there. Mm-hmm. And people will ask, well, why did they do that? People are smart enough to ask, well, why did the star stop? You know, mm-hmm. if it was guided by a star, why did it stop? Well, you better have an answer for that. You yeah. better be able to explain that Matthew was telling the story to adapt it. And if they say, well, wouldn't, why does Luke not mention anything about illegitimacy, or why does he just leave it to your imagination how Mary told about Gabriel's annunciation to Joseph? All of that has to be explained in the popular accounts, if you're a good preacher. Otherwise, your audience is going to say, yeah, the same old stuff over again. All he's got is Exodus 1-2. We all know that story. Boring. So, of course, you fill it out. And they would have known it. And they would have recognized that this is really highly subversive. Mm-hmm. It's not inviting you. It is not inviting you, positively not inviting you to armed rebellion. But it is armed. It is asking you to move, mm-hmm. to move, to go back to your ancient traditions, to go back to your law, to go back to your prophets, and ask, what does this have to do with life under a Roman-appointed king of the Jews? That's subversion. As I say, the fact that it's nonviolent subversion doesn't make it any less subversion. And that's why Jesus will die on a Roman cross. And Rome, when Rome was confronted with violent revolt, it crucified the leader and as many of the main supporters could get their hands on. They crucified 2,000 in Jerusalem in 4 BCE, for example. And you know the story of Barabbas, who's in jail, along with his main supporters. But Rome, when it was confronted with nonviolent rebellion, they described it as causing a tumult among the crowd, did exactly what they did to Jesus. You crucified the leader alone. You don't bother with the followers. They'll all disperse, you think. So by the end of Matthew's gospel, Jesus is going to die on a Roman cross, and he'd be called King of the Jews, and none of his main supporters, the 12 we've been watching come up to Jerusalem with him, the 11 if you want to leave out Judas, will be crucified with him, because this is a nonviolent revolt against Rome. So what Matthew is calling for is nonviolent resistance to Rome. And if you imagine that he's writing this after the terrible violent resistance of 66 to 74, which almost destroyed completely the Jewish homeland, destroyed the temple, destroyed Jerusalem, he's also giving them an alternative vision of how to resist, preferably without getting yourself slaughtered.
Dom, in your book, The First Christmas, David, I know you're getting ready to ask something, but I want to slip this in. The Christmas story of Matthew has Jesus born in Bethlehem, while the Gospel of Luke has Jesus born in Nazareth. Now, unless you study the Gospel parallels, most people wouldn't even notice that.
Is that right about Luke?
Yes, Debo is correct. I give a sort of a headline on this because I really want to talk about that in our fourth, the two profound things that they agree on here. But let me just say this. Yes, in Matthew's gospel, without saying it, Matthew seems to take for granted that Jesus was living in Bethlehem, and after they flee to Egypt and come back, when they come back, they learn that Herod's son Archelaus is running Judea, and they bypass Judea and go straight up to Nazareth. So it does look like Matthew takes it for granted, though he doesn't say it explicitly, that Jesus, Mary, and Joseph were living in Nazareth, fled to Egypt, came back and kept going north to safety in Nazareth.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, quite explicitly, Luke has to figure out how, he's Jesus of Nazareth. That's what everyone knows him. So he must have been living in Nazareth. How on earth do I get into Bethlehem to be born? And his way of doing it is, and here there is an historical mistake, but you know, don't pick on the small stuff. Luke knows that in the, well, let me put it where we know. We know that the year 6 CE, that would be about 10 years after Jesus was born, as best we can figure out. In the year 6 CE, the Romans finally dismissed Archelaus, who was the client king or the puppet king, who took over in the south, in Judea, Samaria, and Idumea, in the south, after his father Herod the Great died in 4 BCE, about the time Jesus was born. Herod Antipas took over Galilee. That's a separate issue. When the Romans took over direct control, in the beginning they usually accepted, you know, a kind of a puppet leader because they know the people better and it was safer. Then eventually Rome took over directly by sending either a procurator or a consul, whichever level they were sending. They sent the first one in 6 CE, they sent the first one to take over the south. Archelaus was dumped into exile somewhere, and the first direct Roman control was put in. And the first thing that direct Roman control did when it took over was count you. And the reason they counted you was not because they liked elections and liked counting or something. It was because they wanted to tax you. So counting was for taxation purposes. And actually, in 6 CE, there was nonviolent resistance to that. I leave that aside for the moment. Mm-hmm. So taxation meant counting. And when Romans counted you, we know a lot about this from tax accounts in Egypt, which was very, very dry, so preserved a lot of these. So you can read the tax accounts. They're run about every, I think, 16 years because, you know, people grow up and new people come. You were commanded in Egypt to stay in your own place. Obviously, they were going to count you by households. Count you by households. And you were told by Roman law in Egypt, don't go running. Don't disappear for a couple of weeks, you know, to somewhere else. Nobody in their right mind in the ancient world ever came up with the idea, everyone go back to their home base where they were born, or your clan base. If you were absentee, let's say you were came from some place in the south, let's say you came from Tepunus and you happened to be go working in Alexandria. Yes, you had to return to your household. They wanted to know where you were. That was the issue. Don't go running around. So what Luke says, however, is doubly wrong. He says it happened in he says it happened in 4 BCE at the death of Herod the Great. That's not the right timing. And also he says that everyone had to go back to their clan base, to the place they came from. For me, for example, that would be going back to Nina, County Tipperary, where I was born, mm-hmm. to be registered. And that would make as much sense for the Irish government to demand that, and then as soon as I get in the plane in Shannon, I come right back here. That's not going to help their tax records. So without getting more into it, Luke is doing his very best as an author who knows a bit about history, but, you know, is no better on the dates than most of it. Maybe he's getting a bit old like me and his dates are getting fuzzy. he has this as the reason they come to Nazareth and Jesus happens to be born. So with all due respect to Luke, and he's a superb author and I do respect him, he's wrong on the date. He's wrong on the reason. And the idea of Mary traveling, probably walking, maybe they have a mule, but maybe they don't, walking all the way to Nazareth when she's in her ninth month.
Which
story shouldn't be pushed too much.
Yeah.
He's going to get her to I'm going to go with Matthew, I think, on this
one. Right. I think you've answered this puzzling question that I have had, and I can't imagine thousands of others, especially women, that of all things, Matthew puts Mary on a donkey, and she and Joseph set off and travel from Galilee all the way to Bethlehem, which is a really long trip, and she's very pregnant, and she's on a donkey over all these rough roads. So I think you've made that make better sense for me. I was always thinking, are you kidding? I'm not going to get on a donkey and I'm about to deliver a baby.
I'm going to have to correct myself. The donkey is, I think, artistic rather than literary. I don't remember, let me see, a donkey. I'm trying to think for a second. I think the donkey is usually shown going into Egypt. And it's usually shown artistically. I don't think there's any donkey
in the text. There's no donkey in the text?
Well, that's even worse because she walked.
No. She has to walk. That's what I said. No. There's no donkey. There's no donkey in Luke's text. Let me make doubly certain. Artistically, they're always showing, you know, going into Egypt. But again, I'm afraid, you know, if you read these stories historically as fact or psychologically as insight, you will go crazy.
Because you'll ask yourself,
you know, it's not very nice that Mary and Joseph take off, you know, God sends an angel, tells them, get out of town, kids are going to get killed. You know, couldn't God send an angel and maybe give her the great, let's be benign, and say, give them a very bad infection, a bad virus infection that puts him into bed so he can't do anything. I mean, if God is running this whole show, the idea of sending his chosen son into Egypt while other people are being slaughtered, not a great story, if you ask.
Yes.
If you take it historically, it roams between horror and romanticism. Do not read it historically. Do not read it either psychologically. Let me give you an example. I'm jumping to Luke for a moment, but in Luke's story, as everyone knows, Jesus is in the manger. He's born and put in the manger because there's no room for them in the inn. And sometimes you get commentaries on that make it sound, well, these are their cruel fellow Jews, that even this poor woman ready to give birth, they force her out into a, you know. No. That's not what Luke... Here's what Luke is imagining. Now, imagining. This is not what happened to Jesus. This is what happened to Luke's imagination. He thinks of Bethlehem. It's the city of David. It's the city where Jesus was born. Okay, it's probably not a city in the Roman sense, but it's a big town. And any big town would have an inn. Think of a caravanserai. On the Silk Road across Turkey, I remember visiting two caravanserais, Abruk Han and Sultan Han, about 20 miles apart on the road from Aksaray to Konya, right across the Anatolian Plateau. Now, these are 12th, 13th century, okay. But they give you an idea of what an inn might have looked like in the Roman time. So imagine a great big quadrangle, walled securely all around, with only one opening at the front which could be protected. All right? As you went in through that gate, on either side, there would be archways, and down the middle there would be open, probably open to the sky. And if you came in with your mules or your camels, you could bed down in those archways. There wouldn't be a door, so you could look out, and you could see your animals safe in the middle. And at the far end, there probably would be more elegant rooms for, you know, richer travelers or somebody who's on the Roman mail system or something, and food and everything else. What Luke imagines is Jesus gets, as it were, to this early Roman caravanserai at Nazareth. They're late getting there, and it's full. None of the rooms are available. None of the archways covered up but open to outside are available. What's down the middle? Troughs with water and troughs with hay for the animals. And they allow the newborn child to be put in the warm straw with the animals. Okay, there are probably more mules and camels than they're liable to be oxen and assen. But that's what it is. So it's not there was no room for them in the inn and they're outside in the street somewhere. There's no room. Uh-huh. Room for them at the inn.
Yes.
But they can stay inside where it's safe and where Jesus can be put as a babe with the hay in one of those troughs. So it's not at all what we might think as an act of cruelty. And we have to be very careful, an act of anti-Judaism or anti-Semitism laced into it. So it's just a tiny little example of knowing the historical matrix and the authorial intention that lets you not kind of make a fool of yourself by saying it means something else. So if you're thinking of it as a woman giving birth, it's at least a consoling vision, probably more consoling than a stone floor, to put it bluntly.
Interesting. Well, one more question. Why is Luke interested in such a humble birth? Why is the inn full? That's his construct. And why does he want that to happen?
But wait, Don, before you answer that question, I want to save that until episode 3.
Okay, I'll save my question.
Great question, but okay. We're out of time. And so I want to not make that transition quite yet, because I know once we get heavy into Luke, Dom, you're going to have lots of surprises for us.
Which will be
good.
Podcast 3. Yeah.
Yes, that's going to be
all
podcast
right.
3.
Behold that as a teaser to podcast 3. And then in the meanwhile, happy Christmas.
Yes. Happy Christmas. Thanks. Well, Dom, this has been great. Thanks, David. We hope that our listening audience is enjoying our series, The First Christmas. If you're interested, please share these podcast with the link to the podcast with your friends and post it on Facebook or Instagram, because this is such great information and probably information that not everyone has taken the time to really study. And Dom, you're bringing this to us and it's absolutely fascinating. So thanks a bunch.
All right.
Okay. This has been a production of the D.L. Dykes Jr. Foundation, producers of Faith and Reason, seminars, and educational programming. Additional funding is provided by the Wendland Cook Foundation. Again, if you're interested in reading Dom and Marcus's book, The First Christmas, it can be found at most bookstores or online, of course, at Amazon. And for home study materials designed to help broaden your awareness, you can visit our website at www.faithandreason.org.